Moncrief on News Talk.
This November, Pamela Lee will be taking part in what some call the sailing version of the World Cup. The route to Rome is 6,500 kilometres long, and Pamela will be the first Irish person to compete in it as a skipper. It's the definition of multitasking. Pamela, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
Tell us about this race, because it sounds terrifying.
Well, yes, as you said, the Route to Rome, it's a very famous race in France. It's based on the old French historical maritime traditions of the old Roman coffee routes. Mm. So it goes from Saint-Malo in France over to Guadeloupe in the Caribbean. And as you said, it's once every 4 years. So it kind of falls into that category for offshore sailors as the World Cup or the Olympics, you know, in our world. So it's quite a big deal even to just get to the starting line, let alone to get to the finishing line.
And is this a solo race or there's more than one person on?
Yeah, it is solo. So it's one sailor on their boat from start to finish.
Yeah. How long, generally speaking? Well, obviously, it's the quicker you go, the better you'll do. But how long does it take to...
Well, there's various classes of boats. The offshore sailing works a little bit. Sometimes I compare it to race car driving. So you have different classes of cars. So depending on the boat, it can be faster or slower. I'm in the class 40. So that's a 40-foot racing boat that I handle myself. And we're kind of the rally car of the fleet. Mm. So I'm kind of on that entry level. Hopefully I'll work up eventually to the bigger boats, but on that entry level. So a little bit slower than some of the other boats, but fast compared to normal standards. So we'd be looking at the fastest, I think, would be 15 days. We'd be looking very good.
Yeah.
But more likely to be 18 to 20 days, depending on the weather. And of course, depending on if you have any damage, you're working with your boat, the mechanical machine. So there's that element of it as well.
Yeah. And how bumpy can it get weather-wise?
It can get extremely bumpy, particularly at the start, because we leave on the 1st of November from Saint-Malo, which is northern France. So essentially, we're going through the North Atlantic in winter. And us here in Ireland, we know what that means. It means low pressures, bad weather coming through. So historically, there's quite a high chance that we'll get some pretty nasty weather, particularly at the very start. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to get south. We're trying to get out of the North Atlantic through the Bay of Biscay, which is also known as a particularly treacherous piece of water, and down south into the trade winds. Yeah. And that's when we get to kind of turn west, put up the spinnaker, which is our big fast sail, and kind of go as fast as we can across to the Caribbean.
And when you're doing that, how much access will you have information in terms of what weather is waiting for you ahead?
Yeah, that's a really good question, actually. Things have changed a lot in the sport. As I said, it's a mechanical sport. It's a sport that plays a lot with technology around a lot of areas. Particularly one thing we work a lot with is solar energy and renewable energy, and performance wise with foils, it kind of plays in the aerospace things. And the other side that's really evolved lately is the communication and the information side of it. And now that we have Starlink, we all have Starlink on board, which means we actually can be connected all the time to the internet, which means we can access what we have the right to access is any free available weather data. Mm-hmm. We can't have anything that's been analysed by anyone else. We have to do all the analysis ourselves, but we can get any free available data and we get that and use it. And so whatever's available out there, we can use. But with weather forecasting, again, as we know in Ireland, it's not always completely correct. Yeah, so we'll often say 3 days out, you have a fairly good picture. 5 days out, you're getting an idea. But more than that, it's really just an overview of what might be happening in the system. So we spend a lot of time looking at it, but you always have to be comparing with the reality around you as well, because it's just a weather prediction.
Yeah.
So about 3 days, we have a good idea. But interestingly, I work with meteorological specialists, especially leading up. And interestingly, it's become harder and harder, actually, to predict the weather. And the storms have become more frequent and more and stronger and harder to predict. And, you know, again, it's a sport. We're playing with nature. We're playing with wind energy. And we're starting to see the effects of the change on our climate and how that's affecting the weather systems, which is very interesting.
But if you're in the race and you know that the quickest route is a straight line, so to speak, pardon my, it's probably not, but I'm totally
say,
ignorant about it.
Never a straight line.
But just for the sake, just to make it for understandable for idiots like me, the Quakers route is a straight line, but you know directly in that straight line is a massive storm. What do you do?
Well, this is a lot of what comes into our training. And sometimes it has happened to me a number of times where you're already out there in the ocean and there's a storm that develops and comes across the path. So, you know, there's no get out. And we spend a lot of time working on preparing how to go into that in the best way possible, preparing yourself and your boat. You're minimizing sail. These are sturdy race boats. Normally, there's always things that go wrong, but it's part of the training. It's about figuring out how to control the controllables. So dealing with the factors on the boat and yourself to deal with that and get through that weather system as best as possible.
Yeah. And if something, God forbid, if something, you know, disastrous happened, how much support is around you? Can you get help pretty quickly?
Well, it really depends on the location and what stage of the race you're at. I was actually involved in a rescue last year in one of my other races. We were just off the coast of France, and I went to the help of a competitor who'd crashed into a cargo ship and the boat had sunk. So in that case, you know, we were the closest rescue. Mm. And that's something we often say in the middle of the Atlantic. If something does happen, your best chance of rescue is one of your competitors. So it's a really interesting human aspect to the sport as well, because although we're all competing against each other, we're kind of we're all in it together as well. Mm. So there's a lot of camaraderie there, and that kind of expedition, adventure kind of allyship with it as well. So, yeah.
And the craft you'll be piloting, is it designed for one person, or does it have to be kind of jury-rigged for one person to do everything?
Yeah, it's another great question. No, this boat that I'm racing, it is specifically designed around being able to be sailed by one or two people. That's kind of most of what I do, solo or double. So the kind of whole ergonomics of the vessel, so to speak, it's kind of like, as you say, a race car. The whole thing is completely empty, apart from all the necessary things. And we have, as much as possible, all the controls to the boat running back into the central cockpit. So it is possible for one person to manage as much as possible on their own. Of course, it's always a little bit trickier, and you have to manage the boat differently than if you have more people on board. But it is built that way, yeah.
Okay, so, okay, we've established it's extremely dangerous and you're quite mad.
My mum's listening.
even to get to the point of entering, what do you have to do? How, like, do you own this, or do you have to kind of lease it?
Yeah, I it's an interesting side of the sport. It's very different from a lot of sports. And I kind of go back to this comparison to motorsports mixed with, I don't know, mountaineering. Yeah. And actually, the way the offshore racing works is 100% on sponsorship. So even to have a glimpse of getting to the Route de Rome in the first place, I have to find sponsors to build the budget, to get a project together, to get a boat in the water, to start sailing before I can even start getting my, you know, having a sniff of my qualification miles, the experience I need to do and all of that to get into the race. So there's this huge business part of the project and sponsor collaboration part of the project that I've been working on for a really long time. And even now I'm still missing a third of the budget we need to do to finish the race.
Oh,
although
gosh.
we're in full speed towards it. So even at the same time that I'm training and racing and preparing myself and the boat for the race, we're also managing, working with sponsors and trying to build up the funding to get it done. So in that way, it's quite a multifaceted challenge, to take on.
Stress fest, it sounds. But are we talking hundreds of thousands to get everything in position?
Yeah, and it varies a lot. Again, I'd say I'm kind of a rookie in the fleet. So some of the teams I'm competing against, a lot of the teams, last year I finished 10th in the championship. And every team ahead of me would have been five times more funded than myself with a newer with a newer boat. So again, it comes into that kind of the money does play into how well you can perform and your chances of completing the race. Because as I said, there's mechanics involved. So yeah, we are talking about like, ideally, if I could get another 100K, then I'd be looking in a really good position for this race.
Yeah.
But as I said, it's all sponsorship and that's how it works. So we're giving back as well, you know, giving back to those sponsors and they're part of the project, and it's a two way thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's a lot to get done.
Have you been using the same boat for a long time, or is this will this be a completely new one?
This
for
boat, Laz, and to answer your previous question, I'm chartering this boat.
Yeah.
So that's a large cost of it as well. In the ideal world, you know, I'd be in the position to buy a boat and have that same boat for a number of seasons and a number of years and be working with that boat and know it really well, working on its performance. But due to the kind of short nature of the project and where I am, I'm chartering this boat. So I've had this boat since May last year. So I've been racing it a year. Mm. I raced it in the championship last year. And my whole idea was to try and have a boat that I would know. You know,
yes,
it's like I think maybe horse riders or someone would compare to it. It's like your buddy, you know, you need to know that boat, and every boat has idiosyncrasies and different ways to be sailed. And you need to spend time on it, knowing all the ins and outs, even from the electrics and the mechanical point of view. I've got to know how to manage the engine to charge the batteries to keep my autopilot going, you know, and there's a lot of detail in it. So really it was important to me to have at least a good season under my belt in the boat that I would be racing on the Ridge Run.
And I assume every time you race it, though, it knocks a bit out of it and then you have to pay for upkeep.
Yeah, another side to it as well. So yeah, every time, I mean, we race the boats hard. You're racing, so you push. They are built to take on hard weather, but that's kind of part of it as well. And yeah, there's a constant upkeep with that. So you have your kind of estimated costs, but there's always a risk that something's going to catch you off guard, a bit like life.
Yeah.
So we're trying to factor that in now. I'll be coming to the end of this block of races. I've got one more solo race now in 2 weeks. And then we'll take the boat out of the water and do what we call a yard period, fixing up all the bits and pieces and trying to get it into the best mode for the Route de Rome. But it's another factor there to consider. I mean, if I've got a bit more budget, you know, I can put a bit more into the preparation of the boat, which is going to make it in a better condition before the start, which is going to give me a better chance of getting to the finish line. So there's multiple factors to consider, which makes it really interesting as well. There's, you know, you're thinking about mechanics, you're thinking about aeroscience, you're thinking about the sails, the sail design, how they're going to work for you, as well as trying to train yourself to be ready to take it on.
And training yourself as well. Would part of that be able to, you have to train yourself to go with, when you're racing, to go without sleep for long periods of time?
Yeah, that's a huge part of it. There's the one side of just trying to be a good sailor, you know, the skill in what that involves. And there's the other side that is very interesting, is learning how to manage yourself and know yourself and kind of, we call it like the red zone. I think we have it. It's taught me a lot about how to deal with life as well.
Mm.
But trying to identify before you get really into that red zone, you know, are you hungry? Are you tired? Are you cold? And catching it just before, even if it's just a little nap before you kind of hit the red zone, and figuring out the different things that work for you on board. And that comes from experience, although it's hard to recreate the situation of being in the middle of the Atlantic on your own.
Yes.
Of course. So it comes from bits of experiences, the shorter races that I've done, but also talking to other sailors and learning from the experience of others and those who've done it before you, and kind of trying to build that. But it's really a sport that the more you do it, the more you grow as well.
And can it be a bit like being a marathon runner, in that you hit a wall at some point? That you might be 4 days out and, you know, you suddenly feel like weeping and giving up, and you have to kind of push through that.
Yeah, it's very much on the endurance side, and there's a huge mental aspect to it as well, which is very interesting. I always say that for me, the kind of second and third night is always really tough, because the first 24 hours you're running on adrenaline. You're off the start line, here you go. You're not sleeping much because there's a lot of boats around, and the adrenaline is pumping. You're probably near coastal areas, so there's a lot of technical navigation, and you still got your sleep rhythms from land, you know. So you're first in that first few days, everything gets a bit messed up, and that's a high potential for hitting a wall. And that's where you need to know to be taking your naps when you can. You have to be very opportunistic about napping, eating, and all that kind of stuff. But then on a longer race, once you kind of get into the rhythm, it's very interesting how your body adapts to sleeping in, you know, short phases and getting through that. But yeah, I mean, there's certainly been times where I've shed a tear in fatigue or frustration at various things.
But you must have to be incredibly fit, because I assume you're not just sitting in the craft, you're kind of racing all over the place doing stuff.
Yeah, and that's, again, it's another very interesting aspect of the sport and a side to it that I really love. Actually, in offshore sailing, there's no male or female category. We all race together on the same teams and on the same race. So it's just for a sailor across the line. And people often ask me, oh, well, is there a disadvantage as a female then because of the physical element of it? And I always say, well, I train to be as fit and as strong that I can be to make my life easier on the boat. But mostly I'm actually training, you know, core and injury prevention for my balance, to be able to keep going when I'm tired, to have that core strength to try and avoid injury. Because if you're talking about a race that takes 20 days, it's not actually how quick you do a sail maneuver that's going to make the difference at the end. It's actually your tactics, where you place the boat. You don't make any mistakes. You don't break anything on the boat. So it's actually a really mental game. Mm-hmm. And it's more about understanding how to use your boat and your strategy. And I think that's why it's actually a very interesting sport to be a female in, because we have a lot of those skills. And, you know, there's a lot of research showing that women are really good at endurance sport. And we have a different way of reflecting on things sometimes. And yeah, you can really use those other elements besides the physicality of it. So, of course, the fitness is really important, but it's not the be all and end all. It's more about looking after yourself. That's not what's going to win you the race. Yeah.
Having said all that, how many women take part, say, in the Route de Rome in the last one?
So actually only 5% of the skippers in the race
are female.
Yeah. So for me, again, it's another thing that I love about the sport, or that I feel is very important about my participation, is I was there at the start 4 years ago, and it really struck me that there were so few women, because the 15 days before the race are a total fanfare. All the boats are in St. Malo and it's a total festival, and there's school groups, there's people walking around. And it just struck me that it seemed so unfair that all the little girls that were there saw themselves so much less represented in the skippers' faces that they could see. And for me, that really reflects, or is like a mirror for life, because in life, like in sailing, there's no male or female category. In a lot of careers, in a lot of industries, it's, you know, we see a much smaller percent of women. But, you know, we can ask the question why, and we can ask the question why in sailing as well. So for me, I feel like it gives me a great position to be able to talk about that kind of thing. Being a woman in a very male dominated industry and sport, even though there's actually no male and female category.
Yeah. Yeah, that is very strange. Somebody's just texted in, sun cream, ?
Love it. Crave by it. Addicted to it. I hide different sticks of sun cream all over the boat so I never forget. I'm like, you know, full block on the face. Sometimes I send, you know, I send videos back for the content. We send a lot of live videos and content back to keep it alive for those who are following. And I'll often see a photo afterwards, and, you know, because I'm not sitting there with a mirror on the boat, and I'm like, Jesus, the sun cream is like not looking cool, you know. So yeah, really important, lathering it on. I really think about that a lot. And then also I try to like look after myself afterwards as well and say sorry to my skin for having just smothered in sun cream for 20 days.
So like, you've enough to be doing when you're racing, I would imagine, but you also have to think about creating content and putting it online and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's a huge element of it. Sailing traditionally probably isn't the most spectator friendly sport, given that we're out in the middle of the Atlantic on our own. But again, another side of it that's really evolved and is very interesting with the Starlink is that actually we can be connected all the time. It's also part of it that comes with the sponsorship side. You know, because of that, we have people following and people interested in the content, but also just part of trying to bring the sport and the adventure to life. So yeah, I'd be sending out a lot of content, videos, updates out to my team. And then on that side, they'll send it out through the content and kind of digest it and send it through. And now it's actually also a requirement for the race. The race direction and race course give us a quota of videos that we have to send out.
Oh,
so it's a huge aspect of the sport now to really try and bring it to viewers and open it up and share the experience and the adventure. So it's tough when you're sitting on your own in the middle of the Atlantic, kind of tired and cranky. The last thing you want to do is put a video in your face. But on the other side of it, the feedback I get from people who are watching and following and sharing the journey is really, really incredible. So, you know, I think it's worth it.
Well, really looking forward to hearing how you do. I'm sure you're going to do us proud. That was Pamela Lee there, who will be taking part in the Rooterum starting on the 1st of November, is it? Yeah, Pamela, thanks a million for coming to talk to us. That was fascinating.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.